This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to Washington Watch. Coming up, it defined a generation, and it saved the world from tyranny. June 6, 1944, Operation Overlord took place to liberate Europe from the Nazis. The D-Day invasion stands among the most significant events in U.S. and world history. Retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin joins me for a discussion of why this event 73 years ago defined a generation, and I'll ask him if how our generation deals with Islamic terrorism will define us. That's coming up. Also, speaking of Islamic terrorists, another attack today in Paris as an apparent lone jihadist attacked a police officer with a hammer outside the Notre Dame Cathedral. Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, is here. And yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled on a case involving the issue of religious freedom. Did the court get it right? Well, FRC's Travis Weber will be here later with the answer. Also, in the wake of the continued attacks on Christians in the Middle East, New Jersey Congressman Chris Smith authored a measure that will bring some aid to the persecuted in Syria and Iraq. In fact, the House is voting on the Iraq and Syria Genocide Emergency Relief Accountability Act in just a few moments on Capitol Hill. Congressman Chris Smith will join us from the House floor later here on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Again, if you miss anything on your way home, you can find it all later right there at TonyPerkins.com. It's archived. And if you're on Twitter and you want to keep up with thoughts on key issues, well, at T. Perkins, the way to do it. All right, as I mentioned, today is the 73rd anniversary of D-Day, when 160,000 Allied forces stormed the beaches of France in what would be the beginning of the end for Adolf Hitler's Nazi regime. And this was a very significant day in the, really, in all of history, but certainly in the 20th century. And one of the things that stands out about this is how the nation was unified. And even our president, who at the time, Franklin Roosevelt, and he led the nation in prayer. In fact, his words are shocking to some who live in this this age of really of secularization, where religion has been pushed out of our really public thought and discussion. Although I would say there's hope, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later as we're seeing this new administration change that. But here's a portion of what President Roosevelt had to say in his D-Day prayer. Listen to this.
Oh, Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in Thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God.
That was the President of the United States 73 years ago, leading the nation in prayer, the D-Day invasion. Joining us now is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former commander of the U.S. Army's elite Delta Force, and the Executive Vice President here at the Family Research Council. General, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tony. Glad to be back, especially on this very special day.
Let me, a lot to talk about in this this day. I want to start before we kind of get into why the D-Day invasion was so important to the Allied victory. But first, we just heard the president, his prayer for the nation. Do you think that many of the younger generation, let me put it that way, would be surprised to learn that the president of the United States led the nation in that prayer?
I think they have been so conditioned to believe in the extreme concept of separation of church and state that they would be shocked. And remember that history is not taught in our public schools the way it was when, certainly when I was in the public school system. So that portion of the history of D-Day and the history of the U.S. Involvement in World War II is something that is, I can assure you, is overlooked unless you're in either a Christian academy or you're homeschooled.
So let's talk about why the D-Day invasion was so important to the Allied victory.
Yeah, well, the Germans controlled most of the mainland, starting certainly up in the Low Countries and going all the way down through France and into Italy. They controlled most of that area. We had already kicked them out of North Africa, but there was no way to bring this war to a conclusion without actually putting coalition forces on the continent itself. We had already gone into Salerno and, down in Italy, but that's an awful long ways from the heart of the Nazi operations there, particularly in France. And so we had to put boots on the ground. We had to take back places like Paris, especially. And remember that D-Day was the 6th of June. And by the middle of August, we had already liberated the entire country of France. It was a hard-fought battle, but we had liberated France and then turned their sights on, headed up towards the Rhine River. And then, of course, you remember there was, in December of that year, was the Battle of the Bulge.
And this was a major, major military undertaking. General Dwight Eisenhower was the Allied commander. It included 5,000 ships, 13,000 aircraft that supported the invasion. The cost was high. More than 9,000 Allied soldiers were killed or wounded, and about 100,000 soldiers began this march across Europe to defeat Hitler. This was significant, and of course now we look back on it and we celebrate this D-Day as a turning point in the war. But Eisenhower, he was not confident. I mean, he put his best foot forward, but there was a lot of things that he could not control. And number one, the weather, which had been a real problem for them. He actually penned two letters, two messages. Yeah. One, if the victory came about, but also one, if they were defeated, taking responsibility for the defeat.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Tony. And nothing like this had ever been done before, certainly not in modern warfare. We say 160,000, but there were another 13,000 paratroopers, as well as another 4,000 that were went in by a glider. And to put that many people ashore against a very determined enemy was such a complex operation, not to mention the fact that it was actually scheduled for the 5th of June, and the weather was so bad that they had to delay it. So they had not only the complexities of putting an international force ashore with probably 180,000 people actually or going in there, and then you add to that the different chains of command and that type of thing. It was a very complex operation, and he was not sure that it was going to be successful. He had the courage to give the order to go. In fact, his famous line on the 5th of June when the weatherman came and said, after having delayed it for 24 hours, it's going to be better, but it's not good. He looked at him and said, okay, we'll go. And that was a very famous line that had been sort of passed down through history. So, yes, he was not totally confident that this was going to succeed.
But as it turned out, it did. It gained the foothold there in France, which allowed the Allied forces to liberate all of Europe. What is so significant about D-Day that it really marked a generation? What does that? What was it? It's more than symbolism, but it's a lot wrapped into that one event that really defined a generation.
It really did, and here's the thing: these people that went on to those beaches that day, which were Canadians, Brits, and Americans, and then a few people from Poland and maybe a few of the Free French, but they were determined. They knew who the enemy was. They knew that the enemy had to be defeated. They were united. And in the case of the Americans, the Brits, and the Canadians, their country was behind them. The leadership was behind them. Everybody wanted to see them succeed. And prayers were going up all over for just that purpose. And they knew when they hit those beaches, there was no such thing as safe space. They knew that the only safe space was on the other side of the German lines, and to get there, they had to overrun the Germans and defeat them. And I think that it was the last time, honestly, that America went into a major military operation with total determination, allowing the commanders to do what they were supposed to do, and with the political considerations taking second place to the demands and the issues associated with the tactical operations as well as the operations.
General Boykin, almost out of time, but I've got to ask you this question. When you look at this taking on the Nazi war machine, this major initiative, what we now know as the D-Day invasion, Operation Overlord, might confronting ISIS and the Islamic terrorists that we see, just constantly attacking, all around the world, even here in the United States, might how we deal with that define our generation?
I think it will, Tony, and I think the major problem is that we've ignored it for too long. We've tried to we've labored under this false assumption that if we would ignore them, they would eventually go away, or they would love us. And so the longer we wait to actually take them on and to deal with their ideology, their theology, and what motivates them, the harder it's going to be. And now you're seeing that in Britain. They've allowed these people to come into Britain, not assimilate, set up these no-go zones, and now what you see is an almost impossible situation. And I admire Theresa May for taking a hard stand the other day, but I don't think that her actions are going to match her words.
All right. General Boykin, always great to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
All right, folks, we still have much more Washington Watch to come. We're going to be talking about the attack today in France with the director of Jihad Watch. Also, Supreme Court issuing a decision on religious liberty. Travis Weber with FRC joins us to talk about the outcome. Don't go away. We're back with more Washington Watch after this.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms, in association with American Family Studios, introduces Ryan DeFrades' Secret Agent.
I'm Ryan DeFrades. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFrades' Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, sweetie!
sweetie. She's an agent. Get her, boys.
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Order yours today at ryansecretagent.com.
So, what would you do with an extra $500 a month in your budget? $500. This isn't hypothetical, by the way. This is something you may need to think about very soon if you decide to become a member of MediShare. MediShare is a way to pay for your health care, and typically it costs $500 less per month for a family versus other health care plans. So seriously, think about this. You could pay off loans, pay down a mortgage, save the money for retirement, donate to charity. That would be a big deal. But you know what? Here's the best thing. MediShare works. It has 250,000 members, and it's growing fast. With MediShare, not only do you save, you don't have to pay for things you don't believe in either, and that is a beautiful thing too. So here's how you can find out more, and you might actually wind up saving even more than $500 a month. So check into it. Here's the number. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23, now available in Montana. 855-PSALM-23.
This is Barry McGuire. I'm a car guy here to help you understand God's purpose for your life through the eyes of a layman. The entirety of life is a spiritual journey. It's like an internship for heaven. We get so caught up with the things of this world, even though they don't even represent a nanosecond of eternity that never ends. Just the song sings, when we've been there 10,000 years, we've only just begun. It could just as rightfully say, when we've been there 10 trillion years, we've only just begun. Putting that in perspective should change the way you live your life today and every day. With the key question being, what is the one thing you're doing today that will matter a trillion years from now? To which there's only one answer. How many of you were moved closer to God today because of what you did and said today? Your job is to ignite revival outside the walls of your church by moving everyone you're with today closer to Jesus. If you want to know how easy that is, go to ROTW.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, yet another attack, a terrorist attack today. This one in France. A Paris police officer shot a man carrying a hammer after he attacked an officer outside the famed Notre Dame Cathedral. French authorities say the Paris attacker shouted, "This is for Syria," at the cathedral. And just days ago, there was an attack on London Bridge. Now, with us is Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch and best-selling author. He works to expose the role of the Islamic Jihad theology and ideology and how that plays into modern global conflicts. Robert, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So what do we know about today's attack and its connection with radical Islam?
Well, this was certainly another Muslim. He was crying out, "This is for Syria." And, of course, Syria is a flashpoint for a lot of jihad propaganda, where supposedly Western armies are committing atrocities against Muslims on a large scale. And this comes around many, many times that Muslims are called upon to take revenge for what is supposedly happening in Syria by attacking civilians on the streets of Britain and the U.S. and also in Western Europe. So this is just another Ramadan attack. There is a promise in the Islamic traditions that jihad attacks during Ramadan have 70 times more the reward than ones outside Ramadan, and that's why we're seeing such an uptick of this kind of thing in the last few days.
So is this something that will pass after the Ramadan celebration ends, or are we seeing an increase in Islamic terror attacks? Because, I mean, we've seen quite a few in the last 12 months.
Well, you know, I think we're going to have a steadily increasing rate because, quite aside from Ramadan, there is the massive influx of the Muslim migrants into Europe and also into North America, unless President Trump is ultimately able to pass some kind of a travel ban or to get some kind of a travel ban through the courts. But in the meantime, there are these refugees or so-called refugees streaming in. The Islamic State or ISIS, vowed as long ago as February 2015 to flood Europe with refugees, as many as 500,000, they said, and to infiltrate the refugee stream and send jihadis into Europe and into North America among the peaceful refugees. We're seeing that happen now. It's already happened that jihadis have struck who have come in with the refugee stream, and we're going to see a whole lot more of that.
Are we going to see, as this increase happens in Europe, are we going to see that potentially happen here in the United States? Is this something we need to be watching for?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, you know, in a certain sense, it's already happened. Because remember that on December 2nd, 2015, Syed Rizwan Farooq and Tashfeen Malik, a married couple, a Muslim couple in San Bernardino, California, murdered 15 people at a Christmas party. Now, remember that Tashfeen Malik was a refugee who had been vetted by five separate U.S. agencies and found to be clear. Well, she wasn't, but this just shows the failure, the futility in light of the mandate in Islam to deceive unbelievers during a war between the believers and the unbelievers. It shows the futility of the vetting process, but it shows that this kind of thing can and will and has already happened in the U.S.
I've been talking about this since the attacks over the weekend with various members of Congress and others we've had on the program this week. But the fact that the president has been so adamant about his ban from the six countries, the ban on those coming that have potential that present potential threats to America, is it that, I mean, man, my thought is, I mean, this guy, he's pretty worked up about this, and I think it's because he knows that America is at risk, the benefit that he has of the intelligence reports, and I think that you know, he's taking aggressive actions to try to protect America. I mean, is he gone too far, or is he being, you know, I mean, is what he's trying to do beneficial to our country?
No, there's no doubt it's beneficial. I mean, look, you really have a hard choice that has to be faced in this. And there are only two choices. And it's unfortunate that that's the case, but this is the situation. We either inconvenience some people who are harmless, or we let in some people who are harmful. In the second case, Americans will die in jihad attacks. Now, so far, except for President Trump, pretty much everybody in the political class in both parties has said, essentially, that we just have to settle for Americans getting killed because we cannot, above all, do anything to inconvenience those who are harmless. And the president, for the first time, is the first person to take the different tack and say, no, we're going to inconvenience some of these harmless people in order to keep out those who are harmful. And that is really the only two choices that we have.
Now, what's driving this is a theology. I mean, this is a worldview that the Islamists have. I mean, how can you eradicate a theology, a mindset? How can this be combated?
This is the huge question that nobody asks, and you are to be commended for asking it, because this is the most important question. The United States has never done this. We went into Iraq and Afghanistan and supervised the installation of Sharia states instead of standing for our own values. We do need to confront it. We need to confront it in many ways. In the first place, there needs to be a concerted effort to show people that it actually is not true. And, of course, the U.S. government may not want to get involved in such a thing because they might think that somehow violating the Establishment Clause or something of that kind. But until we disabuse, as you quite rightly say, until we disabuse people of this ideology, this problem is going to continue. And so I think that the main thing that the U.S. government can do on that basis is to stand for its own principles. And to, if we have any presence in Muslim countries in the future, to make it clear that women who are beaten, that Christians who are persecuted, that Muslims who want to leave Islam and are in fear of death, all these people who are victimized by Islamic law will find refuge among the Americans. And then I think we would find many, many Muslims who would come to us who don't want to live under Islamic law any more than anybody else does.
I think you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, I think that could, in fact, be what we see happen under this administration. Robert, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. We'll have you back on to talk more about this in the future.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com, and follow the links over. All right, yesterday, the Supreme Court handed down a decision on religious freedom, dealing with hospitals and their retirement system. Not a big glamorous case that got a lot of attention, but in there is a very significant decision on religious freedom. Travis Weber, director of FRC Center for Religious Freedom, joins us.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
How do we know where the balance is between saving more money or paying off our debt? Well, it's a difficult question to answer, but I'll say this, that it's about prioritizing. Look, you've got to want and work hard to get out of debt. There's no doubt about it. But if you're working to get out of debt, you're doing nothing as far as savings goes. You're setting yourself up to getting in more debt. You have to balance it. Take one credit card or one piece of debt at a time, usually the smallest one, so that you can feel like you're accomplishing something. And if you have discretionary income every month of, say, $50, then you need to find a balance of putting some of that towards the debt, maybe $25, and the other $25 into savings. See, I don't think it's a good idea to sacrifice either one of them. I think you have to find a good balance to try to accomplish both. Make sure that you continue to save as you're paying off your debt. Now, at some point in time, you're likely to build your savings to where it's adequate, to where you feel as though, hey, if my transmission goes or whatever the situation is, I'll be able to pay for it. And you can commit a little bit more to getting out of debt. The other thing is, look at what you're cutting out of your lifestyle, and anything that you cut out of your lifestyle, put that towards your debt as well.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
This is Washington Watch, and I am Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Tuesday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, yesterday, the Supreme Court, in a 8-0 decision, ruled that the pension plans of faith-based hospitals meet religious exemptions from costly regulations. Now, again, this is not, as I said before the break, not one of those big glamorous cases that gets a lot of attention, but there is significance in this case, and joining us now to talk about it is Travis Weber, director of the Center for Religious Liberty here at the Family Research Council. Travis, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, lay out for our listeners what this case involved and why it's important.
Yes, it is, as you said, it is a case which is not very glamorous on the surface, but the principle of the outcome of the case is an important one for religious liberty. The case dealt with whether under ERISA, Employee Retirement Income Security Act, regarding pension plans, requirements of entities and companies, including the hospitals in this case, whether the hospitals, the faith-based hospitals plans, were exempt from these ERISA requirements or whether they were bound by them. And they were going to be exempt if they were considered church plans under the statute. And ultimately, the court said they were church plans, even though they were not initially established by a church but were set up by the hospitals themselves. The court said the statute clearly protects or exempts such plans that are established by the hospitals, and thus they're not bound by the requirements that ERISA places on any other such plan.
So in essence, what this prevents is from the government defining what a church is and what a church can do.
It would establish that principle, yes. I mean, in this case, it's important to remember we have to look at the statute, and the statute sets forth that church plans, it doesn't really deal with the question of what is a church or what is it?
Right,
what,
right.
What is
but, not but it's kind of like the it's like the camel getting their nose under the tent. That old saying where if the government can come in. It's very similar to there's been a series of these kind of cases on hiring and practices. You know, they had the Hosanna Tabor case a couple years ago where the court unanimously ruled against the administration. So it's while it's not huge, it is important in protecting, if you will, that wall of separation, keeping the government out of the business of the church.
I would very much agree. And, you know, I think this is what's interesting if you look at Justice Sotomayor's concurrence. It's kind of an unnecessary concurrence in which she says that she's troubled by the outcome of the case, even though she agrees the court interpreted the statute correctly. And what does she mean by that? I mean, I think she's troubled by the idea that you could have large religious entities exempt from requirements. And, I mean, ultimately, this was up to Congress at the time. Still is this type of thing is in the hands of Congress. But, she kind of puts her finger on it, on the issue. But this is something we should be happy about, the government being hands-off in terms of regulating unnecessarily a religious organization.
Well, let's continuing discussion about religious freedom today. Vice President Mike Pence spoke at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast, and again, his focus, which has been consistent, talking about this administration's defense of religious freedom.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, glad to see Vice President Pence out front and center on this issue. I was present at the World Summit in Defense of Persecuted Christians, where he gave a great speech clearly articulating that we need to defend religious liberty around the world. We need to call attention to the persecution of Christian communities around the world. And it's good to see this point continually made in the public, because we know the press is all too eager to skip over it or not give it the attention it deserves.
There's been a clear change when we talk about religious freedom, and I don't think we're going to see the outright attacks that we saw from the Obama administration, which, you know, the courts are still dealing with. I think there's going to be a change, but there's still a lot of mopping up to do in various agencies across the spectrum that still have a lot of holdovers from the previous administration that do not have a respect for religious freedom.
Well, right. I mean, I think we see this in a number of different areas. We need to continue to pay attention to ensure that these issues are addressed in the military and the other federal agencies. We know about the case of the Vanderboons and their meatpacking plant. You still have embassies flying rainbow flags around the world. You know, and the State Department should not be pushing these types of things on other nations. They should be in the business of promoting our first freedom and conducting diplomacy. And so, yeah, in a number of areas, you know, we see things that we need to continue to say, hey, we need to get back to where we should be in terms of religious freedom at home and abroad.
All right, Travis Weber, as always, great to have you on. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, Travis Weber, who is the director of FRC Center for Religious Liberty. Really, it ties into what Robert Spencer was saying. The only way that we can confront this ideology of radical Islam is to embrace religious freedom. And it starts here at home. I mean, if we cannot have religious freedom here at home and zealously protected and promoted by our government, how are we going to have credibility to do that abroad? The answer is we won't. So it's very important, both here and in our foreign policy, that we are unequivocally supportive of the human right of religious freedom. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk with Congressman Chris Smith of New Jersey, I think they're still they're wrapping things up on the House floor. He had his emergency aid bill for a Genocide Emergency Relief Accountability Act for Iraq and Syria, for those that have been targeted for genocide. We're going to talk with him about that when we return here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
The AFA Cultural Institute presents Revive Us Again, a powerful new DVD featuring David Butts of Harvest Prayer Ministries.
We need to experience the presence of Christ in a fresh, new way.
Revive Us Again outlines the history and meaning of revival and practical ways to pray for it.
It's time for another great awakening in the United States.
Revive Us Again is available from the AFA Cultural Institute at afastore.net. Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
We're in the financial business. We manage a couple of trusts and some estates and, of course, our own monies, too.
Courtney Trotter talks about the charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation.
I understand annuities about as much as anyone, I guess, can. So I just felt the charitable gift annuity was a win-win situation for many people that still are generating income and still have assets, because you never know when you may have to draw down on something like that. And if you don't ever have to, then it's even a better gift to get to a really good foundation like AFA, a very solid investment, a good way to help do the Lord's work. And it's there to help us as well.
Find out if the charitable gift annuity can work for you by calling the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, as we've been talking about in this program, so critical that we defend religious freedom and we help those being targeted because of their faith. And we've seen what's been happening in the Middle East, Iraq and Syria in particular, where finally, it took a long time, but the previous administration finally admitted that what was taking place there was genocide. Well, one of the champions of religious freedom and human rights, Congressman Chris Smith of New Jersey's 4th Congressional District, authored H.R. 390, the Iraq and Syria Genocide Emergency Relief Accountability Act, and has been pushing for that. And today, that, I believe, was taken up on the House floor. And he joins us now, I believe, just stepping off the House floor from the discussion of the bill. Congressman Chris Smith, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, thank you so very much. And it just passed, so thank you.
And that was on a suspension vote,
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And did it? Was there any opposition?
No, there wasn't. But getting to the floor, I first introduced it last September, and we've been pushing, you know, since then. So that's the better part of 9 months. But it's now passed and on its way to the House, to the Senate.
That's what people make when they make reference to that takes an act of Congress. It could be the best thing since sliced bread, but just getting a vote on it sometimes is a tremendous, you got so many hurdles you have to overcome to get this before your colleagues. But fortunately, leadership working with you and your determination, you got it there. Tell our listeners what this bill would do.
Well, what it does is ensures that especially faith-based entities like the Archdiocese or the Chaldean Catholic Church in Erbil and others that have been basically bypassed by the humanitarian aid funding streams over the last several years If they're competent, they're providing the effective provision of humanitarian assistance, they become eligible to receive this money. And unfortunately, I've had 9 hearings over the last 3-plus years dedicated in whole or in part to, you know, this whole issue of genocide and the fact that so many Christians have not gotten assistance. This ensures that they get it. And I went there right before Christmas, Tony, and I went to the internally displaced persons camp, one of them, in Erbil, Iraq, and was shocked to see, you know, I knew it was the case, but when you see it, all these kids, all these families, and no, you know, U.S. assistance. Private charities stepped up to the plate, but, you know, we know that the church leaders have been triaging the money over the last several years, including right now, in terms of food aid and medicines, because the U.S. government has refused to assist them.
Yeah, when you talk about the funding stream for these relief efforts, you're talking about American tax dollars that are used for these purposes, but they've been intentionally bypassing these faith-based organizations under the previous administration. They're on the ground in many cases doing the work, all with private donations, but this will help them reach more because the need is so great.
That's exactly right. And the Archbishop Huerta, who I met with, and he's the one who invited me there, they're going to be running out of food in June. And so this is really an urgent issue. And there's at least, you know, over 12,000 families that who will be hurt if the food, medicine, and the like is not provided. And I tried. You know, at the hearings, I would ask the pointed questions of administration witnesses last year, the year before, and I would get, well, we're looking into it, Congressman. We'll look into it and get back to you. And then I find when I went over there and went to the one camp that was about 10 minutes drive from the Consul General's office, they had not even been to the camp until they knew I was coming. There's something wrong with that picture.
So that's the embassy, the personnel at the embassy, 10 minutes away from this refugee camp, and had never even been there.
Never even been there. And then they told me not to go. It was too unsafe. So I went without him, without diplomatic security, and frankly, it was a joke. You know, I was met with these children singing Christmas carols, and, you know, I've been in refugee camps over the world. I just got back from South Sudan just 4 days ago. You know, those camps do carry some risk, but this one and this situation was safer than most, but they didn't even want me to go.
Now, what are you hearing, Congressman Smith, as you talk to the survivors of genocide? I mean, their people are being targeted, not just for harassment, but for extermination. What are you hearing from them?
Well, the leadership, the clergy, to a person, expressed concern that where is America? Why aren't you helping us with these humanitarian needs? You know, they're going to some camps, but not to theirs. We heard repeatedly from the Christians themselves, including the leaders, how their faith, and I asked the question, are undiminished, they are strong, they're resilient, they love the Lord, they have been traumatized by beheadings and rapes, loss of loved ones, their churches firebombed, they exploded, even booby-trapped if they try to go back, and yet their faith, like persecuted Christians in the first century, are stronger than ever. And I would ask question after question, family after family, about their faith. And it was like, you know, when I get a bad editorial, I think I'm having a bad day. And these people they're just saints. They are just unbelievable people.
When you see this and you see their faith and their determination to live out their faith, and you see what's been happening in America, where, you know, we've in many ways we acquiesced, not everybody, but many acquiesced to the previous administration that, you know, obviously wasn't what we see happening in the Middle East. But there was certainly, I would say, persecution of religious people here in this country, whether it was through, you know, the HHS mandate that made people violate their faith. I mean, I think, you know, I think we can take a lesson from them in being bold and courageous and standing up for our faith, you know, we're not talking about losing our lives. Maybe we get somebody to tweet something about us or mock us. But, I mean, look, those folks are willing to die for what they believe.
Tony, it's an absolute inspiration for us to be bolder, as Christians can never hate the opposition, but we have to stand up to them and into the wind and not with it. And I think it's far too easy for so many to just go along. Christians are being disinvited from the public square in many of the Western democracies throughout the world, including the United States under the previous administration. You're right. Those attacks on conscience were very calculated, contrary to what President Obama said he would do when he went to Notre Dame and gave that infamous speech at Notre Dame talking about protecting conscience rights, and then did precisely the opposite. We need to stand up. And thankfully, and Mike Pence gave a great speech this morning at a prayer breakfast, the Catholic prayer breakfast, and he's just a wonderful believer. But he talked about, the importance of faith and being informed by it. And I think we have to take the responsibilities of our faith even more to heart and be inspired by what the Christians are suffering around the world. I was just in South Sudan last week, went to refugee camps, three of them, and met with so many believers whose resiliency was astonishing. Had lost everything, had nothing, eating very little, hoping for clean water and some medicine if they're sick or their children, and yet their faith perseveres. So again, we need to, I think, realize that sometimes, it was Solzhenitsyn who said that it was when he lost everything and was in the gulag of the Soviet Union that he realized, how easy it is to be compromised when you don't see the distinction between good and evil, which he saw so clearly under communist dictatorship. So
you're right. Listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins, Congressman Chris Smith of New Jersey, my guest, talking about his bill that just passed on the House floor earlier today, the Iraq-Syria Genocide Emergency Relief Accountability Act of 2017. Speaking of South Sudan, I had a pastor from South Sudan that was at our recent pastors' conference, and encouraged by what's happening in America and giving them hope. Of course, I gave him your contact information because I said you were the man on Capitol Hill that were driving.
I look forward to talking to him.
Well, and I told him that. I said, this is a guy you need to talk to. So I gave him your contact information.
Are
you seeing this, that there is a sense that there has been a sea change when it comes to America's foreign policy? I know we're not seeing it everywhere yet, but the messages, as you mentioned, Mike Pence this morning speaking at the Catholic prayer breakfast, in every one of his speeches, he has been emphasizing the commitment of this administration to religious freedom. That's got to be traveling around the world.
It is traveling around the world, and there is a sense that the culture of life, the protection of the innocent unborn, is now America's new position. I remember trying to explain to diplomats and parliamentarians around the world how the executive branch may have one view, but the House of Representatives is very pro-life, particularly under the Republican leadership that we have today, Kevin McCarthy and company. They're all very pro-life. And it was often a gee whiz fact to them, like, really? Because we get just the opposite from the Obama people, because they pushed hard to promote an unfettered right to abortion with no conscience rights around the globe. And now, thankfully, we have a life-friendly administration, and nobody epitomizes it more than Mike Pence. I remember at the March for Life every year, he would say, "I'm Mike Pence and I'm pro-life." And he'd get a big applause every time. And his speech this year to the march was brilliant.
Yeah, I think there's no question about this administration's commitment on the life issue. Of course, one of the first issues that, Mike Pence drove the initiative to defund Planned Parenthood. Now we see that actually as a possibility of something happening. In ending the taxpayer funding of abortion. What, from your perspective, what are the next major pro-life initiatives that we're going to see coming from Congress?
Well, obviously, the pain-capable legislation, my hope would be that's Trent Frank's bill to protect children who, while they're being dismembered or killed in some other way, feel the excruciating pain of the so-called procedure. You know, from at least 20 weeks on, we know that the empirical data shows those kids feel pain. Dismemberment is a horrific process and includes decapitation, but first the limbs are cut. Well, that induces pain in the child, as then ultimately their death. We've passed that in the House several times. My hope is that the Senate will at some point look to relax the legislative filibuster so that pro-life legislation can proceed. We have the votes to do it with a simple majority, but we don't have 60 votes. So that has been the very, very much of an inhibitor to the enactment of good pro-life laws, including H.R. 7, the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act, which we've passed year in and year out, Congress, you know, each Congress. We've already passed it this year. It's my bill. I'm the prime author of it. We have a simple majority in the Senate, but we don't have 60 votes. And that would do many things. It would take abortion out of Obamacare. You know, the president deceived us when he said to a joint session of Congress in 2009, under our plan, we will not pay use public funds for abortion. Over 1,000 plans pay for abortion on demand under Obamacare. So it would also make permanent all the pro-life riders like the Hyde Amendment, which, Tony, as you know, the empirical data there shows that it has saved in excess of 2 million people who otherwise would have been killed if there was a public subsidy to pay for abortion. And the other side loves to say, oh, where's your data? There's 20 studies that strongly suggest that. So there's a mega-analysis that says that when you don't fund it, there are fewer abortions, and it gives life a greater chance of being preserved. So they're two of the big ones. Born Alive would be another one we'd like to get enacted. You know, there's already a bill, but in places like California, try enforcing the Born Alive Act. You know, we need to have a private right of action, which would give, which would increase the possibility of protecting children once they're born alive during an abortion to get the protection they need as a preemie.
Well, we'll continue that march, and I know you will continue to lead it. And as always, Congressman Chris Smith.
Your leadership. You've been extraordinary. And FRC has been, you know, pro-life to the core and have been very effective on Capitol Hill. So thank you, Tony, for your leadership, but also for your organization.
Well, I appreciate that. It's great to work with you to advance the things that we care about most, life, religious liberty, and our freedoms. Chris, great to talk with you. And
Tony,
I look forward
to talk
to you again.
And thank you so much for calling.
All right. Take care. Congressman Chris Smith, to find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Hopefully this bill will not have any difficulty. The Genocide Emergency Relief Act will not have any difficulty in the Senate, passed overwhelmingly in the House. Hopefully they'll take that up. And our Christian brothers and sisters who have been targeted for genocide and other religious minorities will find the assistance that is there. It's just not creating more money, by the way. This is actually just spending it more effectively by giving it to these organizations that are already there doing the work. All right, folks, you know what that music means. It means we're out of time, unfortunately. But it's been great to have you with us today, and Lord willing, we'll be back again tomorrow. And I hope you will as well. Until then, I leave you with the words of the Apostle Paul. You find him in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, and when you've prepared, gotten ready, and you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.